This is The Mary Davis Show, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with interviews, news, special features, and the community calendar. Now, here is your host, Mary Davis.
Good morning and welcome. I'm your host, Mary Davis. And one of my favorite interviewees is with me this morning. It's Jarvis Tiner. He's based in New York City. And Jarvis, I'm not sure if you're the national chair or the executive chair of the New York State Communist Party.
I'm the head of the New York district.
The chair
of the district, yeah.
You're the chair of the district in New York. And what I want to talk about, there is so much going on, I can't keep track of everything that's going on. But in some way or another, no matter where it happens, and I know there's a thing about all politics is local, but even if it starts nationally or internationally, sooner or later it's going to affect you locally. And that's more or less the way I think about it. And one of the several issues that have come up in the last week, and I know you've been paying attention to it, is one, we have this whole issue with police seem to be out of control. Now, there are thousands of policemen, and certainly not all of them are terrible. There are many good cops I know out there, because I know several here in Buffalo that are pretty decent guys. We have that. We also have another issue that's raging here, and that's low-wage workers, people that work in these fast food places, simply cannot live off of what they make. And it's not a question of, oh, these jobs in McDonald's and Wendy's and whatever else are just for young people getting started. I walk in several McDonald's here in Buffalo, and I see some pretty mature people in there working. Pretty mature people. And then there's also Hillary Clinton coming in and on her walking tour or her listening tour. But she reminds me, I got some problems with Hillary Clinton. And one thing, I don't like coronations. That's one thing. I don't like coronations. But I don't also like that Hillary always reminded me of being too hawkish for me. And she was far too close to Wall Street. It was another thing. And then we also have the situation in the Middle East, you know, particularly with this treaty with Iran, which could cause a lot of trouble. What if this country gets involved in another major war in the Middle East? Now, Iran is certainly not Iraq or Afghanistan. The Iranians probably fight back pretty good. I don't doubt if they would win against the United States, but they could probably cause a hell of a lot of damage. And they got a lot of allies over there, too, that would help them. And there's also this view about Netanyahu that is butting into everything there. You know, and the saying is, of course, you know, as far as Israel is concerned, they would fight to the death of the last American. You know, and it just bothers me on that score, you know, that I'm thinking about there, that this is it. But there's all these things coming up. And in Yemen, you know, we hear all the time about how Saudi Arabia is winning in Yemen, yet they don't seem to be winning. And every time I see this, he'd be in the same place with a lot of bombs, but that's about all. And the same thing in Iraq. It's like ISIS is on the move. It's almost like a giant flow. You know, we hear all the time that they're winning, yet they keep fighting every day. And Iraq may not even be, their military might not even be ready to launch any major attacks for another year or so. So, you know, it's all of these things that are going on. And if these things happen, warlike in the Middle East, it'll soon affect people living in the United States. What is the last war over there, the last 10 years, not only cost thousands of American lives, but something like several $1 trillion in American treasure. And what do they want, to go back in another situation like that? So where do you want to start? We can start with what's going on with the police first.
What I'd like to add to the equation of all those issues, keep in mind we have a very important presidential election looming.
Yes.
And those on extreme right, the Republicans mainly, believe they can win an election if they can get the country all riled up on military and that the president's incompetent, he doesn't want to fight, and Hillary is, you know, let Benghazi happen, and we have to say, so on that issue, they're looking to ride their way into the White House. They got the Congress. They want to ride the White House. The same thing goes with the police issue, which they are the ones who actually are the architects of the militarization of our domestic police forces all across the country. And I have to say that every administration, including the current one, has been a part of this problem of heavy weapons, militarized. But the whole psychology, particularly in poor communities that are black and brown, that you're dealing with criminals. It's a criminal issue. It's a crime issue, not a poverty issue, and so forth. And therefore, we got to be heavy-handed. They want to run on those kind of issues. And certainly in the Middle East, that's the war issue that they're going to try to rip up. And on the wage issue, I think they know that the country wants to end all this economic inequality, and all the polls show it. And it's up to 60% now who believe that the reason we can't provide decent wages for the fast food and other low-paid workers is because the low pay that and the inequality that we experience is the people who are benefited from it are the rich and powerful.
Yeah.
Right now, 60% believe that. But the Republicans are going to try to run on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
That and Cuba and any effort towards peace.
They're trying to derail that, too, as well. I didn't mention that, and that's Cuba.
They don't really care about, they don't really, first and foremost, is not the safety of the country. Because if you put the safety of the country, actually a peace policy would be the best thing, think. But they want to even play with war and even get us involved in the war if they think it'll help them maintain or retake the White House. They already got the majority of the Supreme Court, and they already got the majority of both houses of Congress. So, in effect, for them to take a win all serious statistics on the policies of the politics in the country show that on most issues they do not have a majority.
Mm-hmm.
But they are very, very manipulative and very, very well organized, and most of all, they're very well financed. So that's also, that's the background, I think, the backdrop.
But then one thing you didn't mention, though, Jarvis, and that's the point, if there is a coronation of Hillary Clinton without pushing her more toward liberal policies, that's bad, too, because a lot of Democrats may not even come out and vote.
Right. Well, the thing is that if Hillary follows the policy she followed the last time she ran, I don't think she can beat the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
She ought to learn something from the soaring rhetoric and high, yes, we can, and the fight for ending income inequality and the tale of two cities and the racial divide and the need for unity and the people to have a better economic situation for working people and middle-class people and all that.
Mm-hmm.
If she doesn't go down that road, she's going down the road to defeat.
Well, she's trying to. I think Elizabeth Warren has pushed her more leftward. I would be happy, though, to see somebody else. What about in those debates? Who are we just going to sit there and listen to Hillary? There's nothing going to be there on a national scene that can challenge her or push her.
Well, there are people who are considering running in the primary. I think she'll have some opposition.
Well, you.
But, all the polls show her ahead. But I agree with this pressuring her. You know that de Blasio worked for Hillary when she ran for Senate. But did you know that he's refused to endorse her this time?
Yes, yes.
Want to hear what she has to say on income equality?
Want to hear what she's got to say?
Want to hear what she has to say on affordable housing?
Mm-hmm.
On taxing the rich?
Mm-hmm.
And ending their privileges and so on that they're living off the rest of us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that was very important.
But I think the Clintons, in my own personal thought, I think the Clintons have been in power. And, of course, you know, Bill Clinton's nom de clair or nickname is the big dog. And who's going to challenge him? I think in a lot of ways, Bill and Hillary Clinton and maybe down even to Chelsea think they are entitled to certain things.
Yeah. Well,
it's like the Bushes, basically.
The Bush family is the supremely entitled people who think they're entitled. But
yeah.
I think that you're right. There is something going on with the Clintons in that way. And she had that attitude when she was challenged by Obama, and that she was going to walk into the Democratic nomination.
Mm-hmm.
And when she was losing, You remember?
They were infuriated.
It was a breakdown because she wouldn't recognize that she had lost.
No.
Remember?
They were infuriated. Yeah.
Yeah. Because she just couldn't deal with that reality. That's a little scary.
That is. This is what bothers me about her. I don't know. I think this country be in a bad shape because if she runs with no opposition and not on the stage with anybody challenging her, she's going to lose. And then who would we have?
She'll have some opposition, I think. You know, whether or not...
if it's not Elizabeth Warren, I don't know who.
Whether or not they're formidable and can really take the momentum in the discussion and the debate and so forth and come up with some solid progressive ideas and so on, or whether or not they're just machine-type people who just utter the usual...
platitudes.
Yeah, middle of the road and platitudes and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so God and country, whether they'll just do that, you know, we don't know. But I think there are people that who are capable of putting some heat on her and push her in the right direction.
And then, of course, once she gets there, politicians do lie, you know, to go back on every single thing. What worries me is her attachment to Israel. And under Netanyahu, the Israelis are a problem.
Yeah, I think she agrees with the agreement on Iran, though, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she's come out against that.
Mm-hmm.
She could flip on it, though, and because some Democrats are flipping on it.
Yeah.
Including Chuck Schumer, our senator.
Well, Chuck Schumer, of course, has always been, he's Jewish, but he's always been pro-Israel.
Well, you know, pro-Israel doesn't mean you support Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm.
That's my point. You know, if you're really talking about pro-Israel, what has the policies that Netanyahu is associated with, this militaristic thing, trying to promote war?
Mm-hmm.
They already got nuclear weapons, Israel, by the way.
Yeah.
And the argument that we can have them, but nobody else in the region can have them.
Mm-hmm.
And which, you know, from the military point of view, sure, that makes sense. But from a humanitarian point of view, get rid of all these nuclear weapons. That's
right.
What's going to happen.
Right.
But,
I said before, when they're trying to throw in this poison pill with the Iranians, Jairus, let me tell you, there's no way that Iran is going to do any kind of peace deal with Israel. There's just no way now. They're talking about the Iranians must recognize Israel's right to exist. I don't think the Iranians are going to recognize anything with Israel. I think it would take the last Iranian alive to do that. And even probably the last one standing would probably say no.
I'm not sure the Iranians are that rigid. I think that some Iranians are that way. I think, obviously, if you're watching the reports out of Iran, what the Ayatollah is saying and what the government...
I'm talking about with Netanyahu right now.
Huh?
I'm talking about with Netanyahu right now.
I know, but you see, under the underlying thing is it going to be a region further racked by more conflict over whether or not Iran can be trusted and all that?
Mm-hmm.
This is what the Israelis are really saying. You can't have a deal. So if you can't have a deal, then you better just, you know, load up the guns.
That's
the only way out.
Well, I'm saying that,
and that is not a way out.
No. But who is going to be doing this guns? Who's going to be doing this invasion? Like I said before, not only is Iran a large country, there's 80 million of them.
Yeah.
And they have never started a war. I don't think the Iranians have ever started a war in the last 500 or 600 years. But they do know how to fight. And they would defend their country.
That's right.
And the Russians already had, before the United States had coerced the Russians into not selling them that very sophisticated anti-air defense. You know, but that's breaking down.
Right.
So, it just bothers me, you know, this push toward, who's supposed to fight this? There's not going to be one Israeli soldier in Iran.
I don't know if they can get away with that and push for war. I mean, they've already bombed Iran, you know that.
Oh, yeah, some years ago, wasn't it?
They bombed a nuclear, nuclear energy thing, you know.
How many years ago was that?
Reactor.
How many years ago was that?
A while ago. But, you know,
Rand's changed a lot, I think, since then.
Yeah.
This is what worries me, you know. And when I think, when we talk about national issues, sooner or later they come back home. We got veterans sleeping under bridges now, or can't get adequate medical care now, can't find employment, or got all kinds of mental health problems now from 10 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. We even have the National Guard, which never was always a gentleman's army. And even they have to go into Iraq and Afghanistan 2 and 3 tours of duty. So, you know, what are you going to do with a second major war in the Middle East, which might spread all over the place? You know, there's also Hamas there, and there's, what's this other group?
ISIS.
No, not ISIS. I'm talking about on the other side. There's Hamas and there's Hezbollah.
Oh, you're talking about in
Palestine. In the Middle East, yeah. You know, and they fought pretty good. I mean, in fact, they fought Israel tore up the West Bank, but they got a big bloody nose. And if this was just a guerrilla army, more or less than anything, you know, what are you going to do with a thoroughly modern, mechanized army who is fighting for its country?
You know, I don't think
it just bothers me to think of the misery we already have, and I think about. You just see, I mean, the homeless vets that are out here now with no jobs, no medical care, you know, sleeping under bridges. I mean, most of the homeless population in the United States are veterans.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. I don't want to see that happening all over again.
All right.
Our vets deserve a lot better treatment than that.
In fact, where my office is located, the VA hospital used to be right near here. Now it's some blocks away, but you, in this community, in this neighborhood, it's a big commercial area, you saw more drug addicts.
Yeah.
Heroin addicts, coke addicts, all kinds of addicts, homeless people, all were vets coming to the hospital trying to get a little bit of help.
All vets, that's what I'm talking about. It's terrible.
Life was destroyed by war.
War, yes.
You know?
And I don't want to see that happen again.
No.
I mean, that would be just a major disaster. Who fights this war? I don't think that the British and maybe the French, who are more hawkish, but I can't see the British and Germany going in there and doing that.
Well, the American people have to have a say about any more war, and they're quite war-weary.
We should be. This is the longest war this country has ever fought in our history. We've been in Iraq, 10, 11 years?
Mm. Right.
You know, it's just distressing to me because I think it's just so unfair. And with no draft, that means you're not pulling any of the real upper middle class people, wealthy, into the army. And it's just kind of like many young people who were before looking at the army as an employment opportunity. That's who's fighting this war. And it's not right.
In the last period, more U.S. soldiers
committing suicide
than from combat.
Crap. Yes, you know, it's just terrible. You know, the thought, to me, it's just horrible. You know, to think that could happen. And my God, what would happen in another major Middle East war? It would be a disaster. And you hear some of these people like Leslie, what's his name? John McCain in that bunch. All they haven't seen a war that they didn't like. You know, it's just kind of like someone said about Brzezinski, who was Zbigniew Brzezinski's son. He's very, very right wing. And someone on the show once said that, you know, if you gave him 3 tanks, he would invade Canada. They just don't seem to have a clue because they don't have to worry about fighting it.
Well, you're talking about their world outlook, really. That's the way they see the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
And and you get to the extreme right. They even embrace this theory about if there's a new war in the Middle East and Israel is destroyed, it would speed up the coming of.
If then that mean that Jesus would come back to Jerusalem.
Right. Yeah. resurrection, not the resurrection.
Well, you're talking about a lot of these Christian evangelicals believe that. They support, because they think that the Israelis or the Jews would have a big fight with the Muslims. There'd only be a few Jews left after this big Holocaust, and those Jews that were left would embrace Christ because Christ would come back to Jerusalem, and the Jewish survivors would embrace Christ, and all would be well in the world. Well, you know, I can't imagine. I mean, Jews aren't stupid. I can't. They must laugh at these people thinking that, but they take their money, and they certainly do take their support. But I can't imagine any Jewish person thinking that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I don't know, just sometimes I look at it and it's just, I don't know. And it doesn't look good. I'm pretty sure, I think that Barack and his team probably have something up their sleeve to thwart this move by the right. I'm pretty sure they got something there. They're trying to get a veto-proof Senate, and I'm not really sure they have it yet. And Nancy and Pelosi in the House is a pretty strong leader. She may deny them a veto proof there, even if every last single Republican in the House voted for it.
Well, there is a compromise that they did win.
Yes,
which is that the principle that they view that Congress should have a right to review the agreement. Now,
but the agreement nobody even knows what the agreement is yet. I mean, not officially.
Right. And they're trying to scuttle that, so you don't know. So that let their interpretation stand, that it's basically giving Iran nuclear weapons and allowing for Iran to become a nuclear power and so on. And I would say that that view is held by more Americans than should have it. But I'm not sure it's a majority view in our country now. There was a poll recently about Congress's right to review, that was majority, but I don't think, I think the view that that this agreement should go forward, I think it has majority support in the country, including the majority support of Jewish Americans. I heard a figure that it was up to 80% of Jewish Americans and over 60% of Americans in general who agree that this agreement should go forward. That we're working on now with Iran. Now, if that's the case, who elected Netanyahu?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
And who gives him the power to intervene on our dime, by the way, because that's a power. If you take away U.S. aid to Israel, I'm not sure it could stand on its own, even financially, even economically. But if it could even, certainly not militarily.
No, and he's just meddling all over.
You know, he's selling wolf tickets. And it's going to cost blood and treasure for all of us.
Yeah.
Including Israel. And by the way, nobody talks about it much, but there is a sizable opposition to his policies in Israel.
But he won. He won the election.
He had a treatment of the Arabs. But he won. He won. You're absolutely right. He won. And that's how I'm saying.
And the first time ever that a president did not call him on the first day of his victory. You notice that Barack Obama was 2 days before he even called him.
Yeah. But when it comes to, there's a segment of the electorate that wants peace, but they cannot resist the appeal of war hysteria. And they swing over.
Yeah.
And he basically played that card. He also did some voter suppression of Arabs.
Oh, my God.
Arab voters in Israel. You know, the Arab population in Israel is over a million.
Didn't he, though? And he got really, I think he got
children, too, so I don't
bashed.
Know how large the voters.
Mm-hmm.
But
He did some furious apologizing for that.
Arabs are going to vote, and they're going to take over the election, and he hit hysteria, racism he used.
And that's how he got there. I was amazed at the backlash that he got, though.
Yeah.
From all over. But I don't think they really care. You know, basically, as long as they got the United States Congress, that is, they don't really give a damn.
Right.
Now, what about what's going on in our own country? We just had lately here the 71-year-old wannabe cop. You know, I don't know what the age cutoff should be, but he looked to me like he was not in the greatest physical condition. I don't say that all old people simply because shouldn't be able to do certain things, but I do think that if you're going to do a job like that, which does require some agility, that you certainly need, first of all, to be in physical condition to do that.
That's for sure.
And you know, and I don't know what his other background is. I mean, he's an insurance person, and he donates a lot of money to the sheriff's department there, but I don't know if that qualifies him to be walking.
They call him Sugar Daddy.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. For that sheriff's department. But, you know, that's a dangerous kind of thing. I mean, what should the cutoff age be? I know that they won't even let you be a pilot after 65, I don't think.
I think you're right, yeah.
Yeah, and if it's that old, and you certainly can't get in the regular Army and go down and say, I want to join the Army, and you're over 60. I'm just wondering if that's maybe... And not because just that younger people are better at it. I'm just trying to say that because of the nature of the job, maybe a younger, more physically fit person might be better, or better suited for that.
The problem is not his age. It's his ideology.
Yeah.
I mean, for him to do what he did and then yell out, oh, I didn't mean it. Oops.
I'm sorry. Yeah, oops, I shot him.
Oops, I shot him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was him thinking to cover his ass legally.
Yeah. So that's and then too, how do you buy your way into law enforcement where you're carrying, and he wasn't even carrying a regular police pistol. He was carrying, what, a snub-nosed 38 or something like that?
Well, they now have Tech Nines around the country.
Hmm. Well, let me tell you, he was carrying...
A lot of sheriffs are elected,
mm-hmm.
and they need money to run.
Mm-hmm.
And guys like that can make a difference.
Can make a difference, yeah. So you buy your way into a uniform, and you can prance around as like playing cops, which is dangerous, I think, for the majority population. Who may I? What if you got some of these these play cops out here? You know, that's just something to think about. But you know, I think what gets me, and I talked about this before, we are hearing so much lately about police misconduct. And I know that they said that the cop that ran over the man or with his car, I mean, still in all, that's a 2,000-pound machine. And that it was justified to run over somebody. Look at that guy's alive. But it would just seem to me is that every week we're hearing another incident with American police in some part of the country. And 10 years ago, of course, you wouldn't have heard about this because it would never have been in any papers or any other thing like that. Now, everybody's walking around with a camera. And the sad part about it, most of these cops know that somebody's watching them.
Yeah. Well, the advent of video phones.
Yeah, social media is something else.
Yeah, and social media. I think it's been going on all along.
It has been. That's what I'm saying. But 10 years ago, you didn't hear about it.
Yeah.
You didn't hear about it. Now you hear about it. And the sad part about it is there's such a divide, a racial divide in the country. Most white people, most white people generally think the police are there to protect you, that the police are honorable, and that the police would never do anything dishonorable. Most black people, probably not all, that if you know, like black people do have policemen in their own families, but most view the police quite differently. Most black people view the police in their community as an occupying force.
Right. And that's what they act like, too.
Yeah. It's a total difference.
Something that the people have dreamed up.
Right. Well, if you talk to most white people, they'll say, oh, no, police wouldn't do that. And they never convict because most of them are on juries. They never convict. Most black people, again, as I said before, have a totally different view of police. And that's black ones and white ones, because there's also a blue culture in this country. Just like we had slave traders during slavery, we've got traders today. Black men and women who wear the uniform would sit there and watch another black person being murdered, either help the cop who did the murdering or lie for them. Right here in Buffalo, we had a famous case of Carola Horn. She was a black woman police officer who prevented a white police officer who had a terrible record of brutality in Buffalo from killing a man with a chokehold. She jumped on him and stopped him from doing it. You know what she got for her reward? Instead of being honored, She got fired from her job, lost her pension, and everything else. And the black mayor of Buffalo didn't intervene to try to help the woman at all.
Yeah, he had to be ashamed of himself.
Yes.
And unfortunately, politically, police have political power, too. In a lot of cities. In New York City, you got 34,000 police. It's like an army. As Bloomberg used to say, I've got the second largest army in the world.
Well, that's right. And we saw it can happen in Staten Island. Staten Island must be if I was a black person, I would never want to live in Staten Island.
And, you know, interestingly, Staten Island has become this enclave of segregation out there. But it's one of the places during the anti-slavery period where there were communities of free blacks. And abolitionism was pretty strong out there in some areas of Staten Island.
Well, that was before.
It was kind of the rural area around here.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but every 28 hours, a black person is killed by the police.
Oh, my, that's a terrible statistic.
That's an epidemic.
That's oh, my God. And we're just now basing him. And it's a shock to most people, particularly most white people, who can't believe that this is happening. You know, that black people are just always making these stories up, and they weren't true about the police.
Yeah.
You know, they were just made up things, you know, that police just couldn't do. There's this tendency to believe, particularly white jurors or white people, that the police would never harm anybody.
Well, they're killing white people, too.
They are, but not at the same rate.
Not at the same rate, but actually numerically, I think they may kill more white people than black people.
Mm-hmm. But white people still think of them as being.
That. What is right is the concept of white on white crime,
mm-hmm.
numerically, is taking the lives of more white people than black on white crime, that's for sure.
Yeah, but you don't hear about that. The only time you see crime always has a black face. And a young black male with that face.
Yeah.
And it's just like with poverty, you know, and people say, who's on food and who's on welfare? It's always a black woman with two or three kids that's the welfare problem. And actually, it's far more white people, women particularly, and men, who are receiving food stamps and on welfare. Because there's just more of them than black people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's when you begin to think about it and talk about it, it's just terrible. And again, with this latest crime, with this guy, like you said, shot the man in the back and said, "Oops, I shot him. I'm sorry."
Yeah.
What? What good is that going to do?
Not going to bring him back. That's for sure.
No. And then I don't know if something else, which is maybe a part of what we're talking about now, and that's the hero worship of sports figures. Mr. Hernandez, who probably had some kind of problem for years and years and was convicted of this, but I think that the evidence he was convicted on was pretty circumstantial. I don't know why that they would have convicted him. There was no witnesses or anything else. But this is another type of story that goes to, you know, particularly football heroes. Do we just simply worship our athletes to the point that we're going to give them a pass usually? Or is it the hangover from O.J. Simpson where, we're going to get them, if, you know, particularly if they have a non, say, European last name, surname?
Yeah. I just saw a figure looking at my notes.
Mm-hmm.
Over the span of more than a decade, 2,151 whites have died by being shot by police,
mm-hmm.
compared to 1,130 blacks. And so the poison and the problem is a general problem facing all people,
mm-hmm.
even though probably proportionally you can see more blacks are proportionally going to be killed by the police.
Because there's fewer of them.
Mm-hmm. More whites are killed by police.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an attitude. It's an attitude that they may try to confine to only black and brown people would get the rush, get the kill first attitude,
mm-hmm.
but it spills over to white people as well.
Mm-hmm.
This is really a question of democracy and the abusiveness of the political power structure in the state.
Well, I think you got a point, because the people that were in those marches in New York, when I watched them on TV, there were a lot of white faces in those marches, at those rallies.
Mm-hmm.
A lot.
And I wonder what percentage of people who are killed by the police who are poor or marginal economically.
I think that's another thing.
I will guarantee it's the majority.
I don't think that there's anybody out in some of these, say in Hillary Clinton's neighborhood, have to worry about police shooting them. I don't think so. I don't think there's any worry about that in some of these, in Mitt Romney's neighborhood. Can you just imagine that?
No, you don't see it there. But what about poor white working class neighborhoods?
But that's what I'm saying. You're not going to see that in those neighborhoods. You won't see that.
There's a neighborhood in Cincinnati which has some of the largest number of poor whites. And I don't know the neighborhood. I remember reading a study, though, which was out of the University of Ohio, I think. And in that neighborhood, the statistics on arrest, on robbery, on shootings, on domestic disputes, it is as bad, it is not worse than it is in poor black and Latino communities. So this economic issue is, is at the root of this thing. These are poor people, basically, and the police are not fighting crime, really. They're really fighting poor people.
Keeping them in line, keeping them in check.
Give us jobs, man. You don't have to shoot us. Give us jobs. If we had full employment in those communities, and this is kind of the backward argument of what you were saying about Mitt Romney, and if we had full employment, good housing and things like that in these communities, guess what? I guarantee you the crime rate would be down to near nothing.
To near nothing.
It'd be there. You'd still have some crime, but it'll be down to near nothing.
Why is that, what you just mentioned, so prevalent in some European nations, like Switzerland and Sweden and Denmark? Even in Britain, they have crime, but it's nowhere near what it is here.
Yeah, cops don't even carry guns in some of those places.
Yeah. And there's certainly poor people there. There's got to be some people who are probably not rich that live in those countries.
I think the United States is ahead of everybody on that issue of racially based economic.
Oh, are you saying, of course, that those countries are more homogeneous? That is, they're the vast majority of those people are all of one race.
Yeah.
And that's a factor.
Well, if you go to Northern Europe, there are black people there who have migrated, and there's, you know, people of color who are there who have migrated. But this country, our country, is about to evolve into a majority minority, a so-called non-white country. You know, the truth is that you can't tell where one race begins and another ends.
No, not now.
It's not a biological reality. The whole way we see race. Nobody else in the world sees it that way. Maybe South Africa did, but the thing that's key is that it is a social phenomenon.
Yeah.
It is a system of oppression that is political and social and inculcated into the minds of people. Racial differences and strife goes along with that. And the long history from slavery, Jim Crow, and the whole history of hard urban poverty. You know, I grew up in the ghettos of Philadelphia, and I will tell you, there were families there that will never get out of poverty if things stay there the way they were. And actually, they had trouble raising their kids. Their kids had no purpose. If society won't invest anything in them, won't give them good schools, won't give them training, won't help them get to college, won't help them find a job, society rejects them. Guess what? They're going to reject society.
Well, isn't that like in the Christmas carol about Scrooge, when the three spirits came out and the one spirit lifted up his skirt and said, "This is what you had better worry about." And there were these two really poor, ragged-looking children under his skirt. He said, "This is what you'd better worry about."
Yeah.
If you ever watch A Christmas Carol, and one of the ghosts, I think probably the ghost of Christmas coming or something like that, or the ghost of Christmas present, I'm telling Scrooge that this is what you're going to have to worry about. And he lifted his skirt. This boy and this girl, this is hunger and want or whatever it was like that. It was like a warning that if you don't watch out, this is what's going to be your future. Because this is who you have to worry about.
That's Charles Dickens, right?
Yes.
Well, he was a social critic, basically.
Yeah, and that was now how many? That was what in the 1830s, I think.
Yeah. Well, the problem's been around a long time.
But I mean, what you said is that this is what you will reap when these people come by, because even today, you know, during the Depression in 1929, in 1930-31. You know, people, more middle-class people and other people, they either jumped out of windows, they couldn't bear it, or the poor just stood in bread lines. But I don't think that's quite the same kind of attitude today. You know, I don't see any middle-class bankers jumping out of windows, and I don't see...
There's some of that.
But, I mean, I don't see the poor standing passively as what they did then.
That's right.
It's kind of an attitude, no, we deserve more than this, and we'll do it one way or the other. We'll steal it or revolt or whatever it is. But it's just not that same passive stance. Well, this is the hand that God gave me, and I just have to live with it.
Yeah, or the notion that, well, I failed because, look, Mr. Rockefeller, he worked hard and he got it, and I guess I didn't work hard enough. Nobody believes that anymore.
No, nobody. But Mr. Rockefeller got his money from his old man and his grandfather.
That's right.
You know, that's inherited wealth.
They come from robber barons.
That's right. Yeah. You know, and that's how they got it. But I'm just saying the attitude, it seems, is different. And, of course, like they're talking about it with Hillary Clinton and the Clintons feeling that they're entitled. These millennials, and the millennials anywhere from 18 to 35, or some people say maybe from 13 to 34, would be classified as millennials. That group of young people, they're not as racist as their parents and grandparents. That's one thing. They're more liberal in thinking about issues like homosexual marriages or gay marriage, this type of thing. They're more liberal in other thoughts about other people than were their parents and their grandparents. Not all of them, of course, but a good majority, especially those that elected Barack Obama.
Yeah.
You know, and that's...
Well, I think their parents went through the 60s, and a lot of them drew conclusions that racial injustice and disparities in the basic social life, you know, economics, political, and so on, had their root in racism.
Yes.
Economic racism in a very basic way. Mm-hmm. And also, how many of them, after they saw what happened in Selma, and what happened to those three children in Birmingham Church, 16th Street Baptist Church, blown up, killed these children, turned to their kids, says, don't you ever practice racism in my house. You know, how many turned to them and said that's bad?
That's
you
bad,
shouldn't
yeah.
do that. Mm-hmm. Even though themselves they may have had some problems with it. Mm-hmm. But they saw the social implications of it in the harsh reality of racial violence directed against black people and oppression. Mm-hmm. And they told the kids, so some of these kids have grown up, and some of their parents have grown up, have grown in their political thinking. And that's where you get this generation today. You know, they've seen black people on television. You know, there was a time you didn't see any black people on
television. Yeah.
I remember when the New York Knicks had no black players.
None?
They got Sweetwater Clifton from the Harlem Globetrotters.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Now, I mean, that was in the 50s.
Oh, my God. You know, sometimes I wonder, people, I don't say this basically here because, you know, most people, especially on my job, are very nice to me. So I don't have that type of complaint. But also, there are not that many African-Americans that work here either. But the point is, I guess you have to stop to think that people do evolve in their thinking. I guess that's true, that people do evolve. You know, people change.
And people like you, Mary, who keep hitting on these issues, don't ever give up.
No.
Believe me. No, I'm serious. Believe me. People need to hear what you have to say. They may not agree at first. But, you know, when you tell the truth, it fits reality.
Yes.
And it gives people another perspective so they can look at that reality and say, that's not right. That's not. And that's why there's big polls now. We're talking about economic inequality.
Isn't that amazing? Even the Republicans are talking about that.
Yeah,
but who started talking about that? That was Elizabeth Warren. That was Elizabeth Warren, and nobody thought would beat, what's her name, Brown, who ran against her, that she ran against him in Massachusetts? what was his name? He tried to beat her. She ran against him, and took. He was the one that got a Ted Kennedy seat first.
Yeah,
I think his last name was Brown.
Yeah, I think his name was Brown too. I can't think of his first name. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was that to me. I couldn't think of it. But she ran against it, and her main platform was that. And now it's kind of like a battle cry for just about everybody. Now I hear Republicans saying this. I'm kind of shocked.
Yeah.
You know, and they're talking about economic opportunity. Who's that? Ted Cruz, of all people.
Yeah.
You know, this is kind of like becoming the battle cry because that's where most Americans, and you're rightly so, you said these polls are showing a difference, you know, where people are starting to think more and more and more that way than they did before. Mm-hmm. They're just thinking more and more and more that way now. You know, and there's just no getting around it because that's what they're thinking now. And it's a good thing, I think, because when the middle class and, you know, the middle class is where you aspire to be if you were in the working class. But you look at the middle class is getting their behinds kicked all over the place. You know, when you have to be, what was it before when the middle class had to work, people in the middle class had to work three jobs to keep up their standard of living?
Mm.
You know, two and three jobs.
Yeah.
Now, this was people that were in the middle class. You know, it's homeowners living pretty good. You know, jobs in construction, jobs in steel, jobs in automakers. You know, people coming home with $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year, keeping up that middle-class lifestyle. That's not there anymore. And the auto workers took a terrible beating when the auto industry almost went broke. And what the union had to settle for was a lot less than what those workers had previously got. A good friend of mine, Nathan Head, who was out of Detroit, and he was the person who was head of the Civil Rights Division in the auto workers, AFL-CIO. And he said, all of the rights that we won, he said, and most of the white workers we had in the union voted Republican because we put them in the middle class. And then they started voting Republican. Well, I bet you they're not voting so much that way now.
Yeah, in fact, if you remember with the situation in Ohio, the role that auto workers played actually in defeating the anti-labor policies of Kasich.
Yeah.
But he got a lot of votes. He got a big chunk of the black vote when he ran again for governor. But his policy of outlawing public workers' unions, that took a defeat from some of those same people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at issue after issue, the other side is very clever to turn a positive change into a negative. And a negative into a positive. They know how to do that.
Very well.
A lot of workers who are not paying attention and are working every day trying to feed their family and don't have a chance to think through things or hear an opposing point of view, they end up a lot of times caught in that web. Yeah.
They would not. As my sister used to say, God rest her soul, she's passed away now, but she used to say, and she was mainly talking about white workers, but there were a lot of black workers in there too, and brown ones. They don't vote their own interest.
Mm-hmm.
They vote against their own interest. And they get so hyped up on this stereotypes and these racial hang-ups that they don't vote their own interest when their interest is frankly with alliances with black and brown workers. All of them should build these alliances and they would all win. But as you were right to say, these rich corporations and these other, they know how to use that divide and conquer stuff and use it based on racism and classism. You know, most of these workers who think, oh, well, yeah, if I just work hard and live good, I'm going to have as much money as Donald Trump. No, you're not. You're never going to have it.
Face it.
Right. You know, this is not going to happen
but
for you.
You deserve a good life.
But, you don't deserve to starve to death either. You know, you deserve a good life. But, you know, you're never going to have what Donald Trump, no matter what Mitt Romney would stamp in and say, well, yeah, if you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But what if you don't have any bootstraps to pull yourself up with? You know, what if your father didn't make a whole lot of money to leave you and his father before him that left money to your father, that you could do it to you. You know, we're not going to have that. But yet many people believe that. Many American workers do. They believe that. That they're poor because it's their own fault that they're poor.
Right. You have a lot of workers who refused to take welfare, even though they were destitute, because they felt that they were robbing people. They were stealing. They were getting something they didn't deserve. They didn't know that it came out of their tax money.
It came out of their tax
money. When they're working, they pay taxes. But when they're not working, their aunt in Cleveland is paying taxes that go back into the same fund, and certainly your aunt wouldn't deny you.
That's it.
It's your money.
It's your money. It's your money.
And when times get hard, you have a right to lay claim of it.
That's it. And so many people that came up, especially, I think, that people coming along maybe in the 40s or grandparents and some parents that came along in the 30s and 40s thought that being on welfare was the biggest dishonor that you could face, that you had to take public assistance.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there are many people today that do that. And there's so many other disparities that go on that we have to think about and deal with. And I look at President Barack Obama. That man, when he went into office, he was in his early 40s, or just about middle 40s. His hair was all one color. You look at him, I mean, his hair now is salt and pepper.
Mm-hmm.
So he's been there not quite 8 years, and his hair is salt and pepper. And it's amazing what a toll it's taken on him. But when you have to fight so hard just for your own identity, and I said this on television too, and the sad part about many of these Republicans, and unfortunately many of our fellow citizens who are white, most of them, they have it's like a core belief that black people are just not legitimate, that we're not bona fide, that we really have no right to be here. That we're counterfeit citizens, that we really are not citizens of the United States. Although most, in fact, all black people generally who are in the United States were here before most ethnic groups that are here today. Certainly here before the Irish, before the Italians, many before the Germans. But we're here.
Right. First people to occupy this land.
Yeah. We're Native Americans.
That's right. Hey, they weren't white.
No, but you know, it's a shame to think that. But this is why I think that people can't believe certain things about police brutality, or people just can't believe that why Republicans, I think, not only dislike Barack Obama, they hate the man, but basically because they consider him illegitimate. Who was ever asked? Ted Cruz was born in Canada?
Ted Cruz was born in Canada.
But yet no one's asked him for his birth certificate. It doesn't even come up. Well, I mean, Canada, the last I knew, was a separate country. It was not the United States. I know both his parents. I know one of his parents was an American citizen.
Yeah. And that's what it tells you. You can still run for president if your mother's one. So basically all that hullabaloo around Obama not being a citizen.
It was just the idea we cannot accept this man.
Even if he has
as being an American. How dare he sit in the White House? You know, it's unthinkable. It's unthinkable. How could he be in the White House? You know, he's just simply not legitimate. He is not an American. He's not like us. Well, yeah, I'm sitting here and I'm probably not like you either. And you're there in New York City. You're probably not like them either. But we're here. I mean, my ancestry in this country goes back to the 1700s. I don't know how many people can beat that.
Not only that, anybody who says that African Americans or any people of color have not contributed to this economy.
Of course we've contributed. Everybody here has contributed.
They're out of their mind in the first place, but they are politically wrong.
Mm-hmm.
In every respect. They are morally wrong in every respect. And if they believe in religion, you are in violation of Christian ethics to make up such nonsense. Well, first of all, you don't even know half the people. But this country got its initial wealth from the slavery, the hard work and suffering, the blood, sweat, and tears of people of African descent.
Oh, God, yes.
And the genocide against the Indians, who they removed to clear the land.
Right.
And so on. That the ultimate sacrifice, working for the rest of your life for nothing, never getting paid,
yeah.
while the rich people slave owners and the businessmen who benefited from the
sweat and blood of these
goods
people
that were produced as a result of slave labor, including slaves were used in factories and shipbuilding. Frederick Douglass was a shipbuilder.
Yeah.
You know, and
even peonage lasted in this country until the 1940s. There was peonage here where you could be arrested for vagrancy and forced to work for different companies for nothing.
That's right.
Yeah.
Prison labor.
Prison. And, you know, people didn't realize that. I said, oh, no, there was some forms of slavery in the United States that lasted through the 40s. It was called peonage.
That's right.
You know,
you know, the first slaves in the United States were white.
Indentured servants. Well, they were white Europeans.
They didn't have to be slaves for life.
No. They could get their way out.
They could get married. Mm-hmm. They could live a regular life.
Mm-hmm.
And the first black slaves they brought here, they allowed them to be indentured slaves. But
they needed somebody who's going to be impetual slaves. That's what they needed.
And start businesses and establish an independent life. And wait a minute, that's a threat to slavery.
That's
a threat. You have to have a slave that has no choice.
No choice, and that you could work forever, and his prodigy. And they did that, of course, by saying you would follow the condition of the mother.
Mm-hmm.
If the mother was a slave, no matter what the father was, you were going to be a slave.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just about it. Well, I got 3 minutes left. We've had a roving conversation. What were some of the things you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, yesterday I was at the big wage thing, the fight for $15 an hour for low-paid workers. Now, that's not going to be a total answer to the economic, but guess what they've discovered? When the federal wage is somewhat $8 or something an hour.
Well, the federal wage went up a little bit. I think the state wage, isn't the state wage up? It had to have been like, what, $7.50?
State wage is up, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they want to move it to $10. I think Cuomo agrees with $10, but the movement's gone for $15. And I believe that's right. You know, Seattle has a $15. Oakland, California, I think, has a $15. There are other cities who have passed.
Well, Cuomo has his eye on Wall Street because he's totally in bed with Wall Street.
Yes, he is. But he also is running as a Democrat, and he got to win the support of a large number of, well, I would say, progressive and liberal voters.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to play both sides of the street, but he likes it on the other side better.
Yeah, he does like it on the other side better. The other side got a lot more money.
But I think his presidential aspirations are rather dashed for now, because basically he would have trouble running as president, winning his own state right now.
Right
There's
now, he would.
Opposition to him.
It's like Chris Christie, who's talking about all the states he can win, he's planning on winning, and yet he couldn't right now. Chris Christie couldn't win New Jersey.
That's right.
You know, so that I thought that was ironic when I was listening to him sprouting out all the states he could win, and his disapproval rate in New Jersey is 60%. This is great, you know. You can't win your own state. You know,
so, and that's the people who know him best.
They know him best. And they don't like
him. You don't even know him.
And you don't even know him.
Yeah.
I guess we're going to have to say goodbye. We have to talk about this on TV as well. So when are you going to come back and talk to me on TV?
Right.
I'm asking you.
Say it again.
When are you going to come back and talk to me on TV?
Oh, just please let me know and I'll let you know. I can't tell you abstractly when. You have to tell me when you think I can do it.
Okay, I will do that. Because, as you say, I think there's so many things going on. I it's just so hard for me to kind of keep track of everything that's moving. It's like things are coming at me 100 miles an hour. So many different issues. It's hard to keep. And I try to cover as many of them as I can. But that's going to be it for me for this morning. I want to thank my guest out in New York City, Jarvis Tyner. And he's always a welcome guest here. He's always interesting, has so much to say from another point of view. And I do appreciate that. Jarvis, you have a wonderful day.
You too, and thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye now.
You've been listening to The Mary Davis Show. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Mary Davis, 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.